we have had a week. First full week of school, and the news about Jane. So good to see her out and about, and praying for her as she continues to get stronger after her time in the hospital. My family's out. Half of them are still out. The subject this morning is continuing our annual theme of the art of loving. And the focus this morning is on learning to love our children. And that is such a huge topic. It's basically a lesson for us as parents. How do we parent our children well? How do we love them through our parenting? And if you just go and start asking people, how do I parent? You will never stop. You will never stop asking that question. There was a mommy blogger that had this to say about the topic of parenting, as she tried to figure out how to start doing that. She said that she tackled the subject like she would anything else. She wrote and she read and she consulted the experts. So she started looking up attachment parenting experts, positive parenting experts, tiger moms, French moms, Dr. Sears, Dr. Spock, Doctor Who. She started asking everybody, what do I do? Then she said, do you know how many parenting experts there are out there? If you just were to estimate, her estimate was 3 billion. There were 3 billion parenting experts. And if you include the random strangers in grocery stores that have some advice for you, that balloons to 5 billion. You know, the topic of parenting is just, it's a huge, and everybody has an opinion about it. And the opinions change all of the time. But what we're going to do is we're going to try to approach parenting and what that looks like in a loving way from what God has to say. And, you know, that was the topic. I went to my bookshelf. What books have I appreciated on parenting? And it was a stack. And so weeding through that stack, what are some biblical principles that we can distill in a good half hour, 40-minute lesson? And I think we need to start with this. This is the reason that there are so many experts. This is the reason why everyone has something to say. It's because we understand the value that children have. In Mark chapter 10, verses 13 through 16, they were bringing children to Jesus that he might touch them, and the disciples rebuked them. But when Jesus saw it, he was indignant and said to them, "Let the children come to me. Do not hinder them, for such belongs to the kingdom of God. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it." And he took them in his arms and blessed them, laying his hands on them. Jesus acknowledged the value of children. And when you look at other passages, just a couple more. Psalm 127, 3 through 5. We understand that the Bible describes children as a gift. "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate." The psalmist sees children as a blessing, as a gift from God. In Genesis 33 and verse 5, when Jacob and Esau meet each other again after their separation, Esau lifts up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, "Who are these with you?" And Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given to your servant." Children are a gift to any home. And it doesn't matter the details of how a child comes into this world, because they don't get to choose that. But we should see children as a gift. And so what do we do with this gift? If we value this gift like we should, it ought to be a really big, important subject that we try to sort out. It ought to be something that we have deep convictions about. How do we interact with these precious people? So this morning, let's quickly talk about 7 ways that we can love our children. In the context of a home, in the context of parenting, how can we do that? I'd like to suggest this morning the first way that we can do that is by cultivating a Christ-centered home. Cultivating a Christ-centered home. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 15 through 17, Peter, in addressing the Christians who were going through suffering, said this: in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. Some of your versions will say, sanctify the Lord as holy. Always being prepared to make a defense. That first phrase, in your hearts, sanctify Christ the Lord as holy. He's saying the most important person in any Christian's life needs to be Jesus. And as I think about all the relationships that I have, whether I'm thinking about my parents, my siblings, my nephews, my nieces, my wife, my children, my friends, when I think about all the relationships that I have in my life, the most important one, according to 1 Peter 3, needs to be Christ. Christ is the one who determines what I'm going to do at the end of the day. And what I do and how it helps and strengthens that relationship or weakens that relationship is going to be the determining factor in my life. My relationship with Jesus needs to be the most important thing. It's the most holy, sanctified thing. Paul said the same thing. Paul said the same thing over in 2 Corinthians 5:9 when he said, whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim, our goal, to live pleasing to Him. The most important thing in Paul's life was his relationship with Christ and to please Christ. What does that have to do with parenting? Because the temptation is, as soon as children come along, is that Christ can be replaced with the child. And Jesus is no longer the center of the home. In a very literal, physical, tangible way, the child becomes the center of the home. And everything in that home revolves around, is Johnny happy? Is Johnny not happy? Does Johnny like this? What does Johnny want to do? What are Johnny's preferences? And those are good questions to ask, but they need to come under, but what does Christ want? What does Christ want? You know, in the hierarchy of relationships, Christ needs to be the center of the home, but there's another relationship that needs to be central. And that's the relationship of the parents toward each other. That's a sacred relationship. I mean, you think about the commitments that a husband and wife make toward each other when they exchange their vows. And you think about the nature of their relationship. There's no whiteboard, so I can't doodle this. But you think about the dynamics of the life cycle of relationships. The way God designed it, the very first relationship that He created on earth was between Adam and Eve, this man and woman, this husband and wife. And they entered into this relationship, and what did God explain about that relationship? He explained that it was meant to be a until death do you part. This is my lifelong commitment. That this is a permanent relationship. But eventually they're going to become children. Children are going to enter this picture. But over in Genesis, he explains that there's going to be this leaving and cleaving process. That eventually children will leave the home of their parents. So there's this temporary nature of a relationship. And in many instances, they will form their own marriage. And so you've got this permanent relationship of marriage with a temporary child living in the home for 18, 19, 20, 30 years. Right? But the intent and goal and purpose is that the child, the parent-child relationship, is not the same as the spousal relationship. If parents don't put Christ at the center of their home, and they don't elevate and respect the marital relationship like they should, all of a sudden, the children become center. They become central. They rule. Actually, what happens is they dictate. God never intended for them to be the center of the home. Ever. We've put them in a place that they don't even function well in because God did not design them to be in that role. And so we need to put Christ back at the center. back at the center of the home. There's this one gentleman who is leading a marriage seminar that said one of the ways that they tried to do that within their marriage, they figured it out. They didn't start out this way, but they figured out really quick, we need to change some things. And what they realized was they needed to do a better job with their spouse-to-spouse relationship, their marriage relationship, and making sure that was more central. And so the way that they would do that was when he came home from work every day, the very first thing that they would do is he and his wife would go to the bedroom to have 5 or 10 minutes to talk and catch up without the kids. And that was their habit Monday through Friday. And that was a hard adjustment. They hadn't been doing it. So what do you think happened when they started? They go up. Okay, kids, mommy and daddy are going to go talk. You're going to what? And we're going to go into the bedroom and we're going to close the door. We'll be out in about 5 or 10 minutes. Well, the kids follow them up to the room and the door closes and they're banging. What are you doing in there? Are you going to come out? What's for dinner? You know, little fingers are creeping underneath the door. What's going on? But what mom and dad are trying to communicate is our marriage is important. And you're going to be okay. Don't eat each other alive. We'll be out in 5 to 10 minutes. Right? Cultivate a Christ-centered home. What's the second way that we can show love? We can show love by tenderly addressing their hearts. We need to tenderly address the heart of our children. I think one of the books that I appreciate the most that does a good job helping us think through how to do this is Ted Tripp's book, Shepherding a Child's Heart. Proverbs 4:23, keep your heart with all vigilance or diligence, for from it flows the springs of life. And his point is this, when it comes to parenting, we're trying to help our children with the exact same things that we're working on, that God's working on us about. And what's easy to focus on, whether it's an adult or whether it's a child, is it's easy to focus on behavior. And we'll categorize this as desirable, acceptable behavior. This is undesirable, unacceptable behavior. And we think our job is just to get children from one to the other, or to get people from one to the other. You know, if you would simply stop doing XYZ and start doing ABC, we'd be great. But there's more to us than simply behavior. What the proverb helps us understand is there's a heart. There are their desires and there are emotions and there are thoughts and ideas, and all of those things are going on inside of us that lead us to do what we do. In Luke 6:45, Jesus said, the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good. The evil person out of the evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so what these verses help us and challenge us as parents, what they challenge us to think about is, there's more to behavior than our child's behavior. And it's not enough to just say, just stop that, just stop that, just stop that. We need to help them think through, why are you choosing to do that? Why are you choosing to do that? Let's think through that. What's going on inside of you? What does your behavior reveal about you inside? And we need to work through that. That takes a lot more time. That takes a lot more patience. But I think in the long run, that's the right way to do it. And that's what God does with us. God addresses us internally. He addresses our pride and He addresses our fears. He addresses our anxiety. He addresses all of that. And if God's willing to take the time as our Father, we need to do the same with the children that He's gifted to us. And that kind of leads us into the third thing. We can love our children by developing a biblical perspective of children. Developing a biblical perspective of children. Just this last week, there are a couple of us that get together on a semi-regular basis, and this year we've been reading through Proverbs a chapter at a time. And we were reading through Proverbs 22, and we had an interesting discussion about this verse. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. I mean, deposit that check, bank it. Like, You're good. All you have to do is give the right information into a kid and boom, like a robot, they'll do what's right. Right? No. I mean, everyone with any kind of experience in the room just mouthed no. There are a couple of things about this passage. One is we could take it as a general truth. A lot of Proverbs are that. They're generalizations. These are generally true. You could approach verse 6 that way. Another suggestion is to think about individual children. Train up a child in verse 6. In his way is what some paraphrases will say. Train up a child in his way. The thought is that every child is unique. Every child is different. Every child has different strengths. Every child has different weaknesses. Children have different desires. That your child will respond differently, typically based on their gender. So you have that thrown into the mix. Children have different shaping influences. And as you take all of that into account, what we're saying is each child is different. And so train that child understanding their differences in the way that child should go. With a Godward focus, absolutely. But develop a biblical perspective of your child. That's an interesting way to approach Proverbs 22:6. Think about some of the things we just rattled off. As you look at your child, think about the things that influence them. Professionals will talk about the shaping influences in your child's life. The structure of their family life. The things your family values. The roles within your family. The habits of conflict resolution. The way your family responds to failures. Your family history. Birth order. How many kids are there? Is this a first or a second marriage? Is this a blended family? Are there living grandparents? Are there aunts and uncles? Those are all shaping influences. We need to be aware of those. Those play a part in the development of our children. And then you tie in their personalities, strengths, weaknesses, and desires. You tie in their gender. Just in the last couple of weeks, Anna was in the foyer, and she was visiting with Jordan Oliver. And Anna was holding Felicity. And Jordan asked, you know, can I hold her? And Anna said, yeah. And so she gave Felicity to Jordan. And for the first 10, 15, 20 seconds, Felicity was fine because for some reason she thought Jordan was me because we just look so much alike. And that's whoever that's a compliment for. But after 15, 20 seconds, and she started to pay more attention, she realized this ruggedly good-looking man is not my dad. And so as Jordan held her, a transformation took place. You know, her little lip came out about 2 inches. And her brows went down. And her eyes welled up with a lot of water. And the surface tension was incredible before it broke. And the tears started to come down. And I think Jordan's face mirrored hers as he watched her melt down. And as Jordan was explaining all of this to me later, he said, I have boys. I've been around boys. I have never had one of my children do that before. Well, you have boys. You have boys. There are differences. And we need to parent understanding that they're different. They're not carbon copies of each other. What works for one might not work for another. Welcome to parenting. Welcome to parenting. You know, there are two opposite ends of a spectrum that we could approach to all of this. And I think we need to briefly mention it. When it comes to understanding our children and their uniqueness, and the shaping influences and all the things we talked about, there are some people that look at those things as if they are deterministic. What that means is Their influences are going to guarantee my child will turn out a certain way. Their gender will guarantee they will turn out a certain way. Their personality will guarantee my children will turn out a certain way. That's not true. I think that's a flawed assumption. That's one end of this spectrum. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are people that just don't care at all. I think that's a foolish end of the spectrum. And in the middle, I think, is what the Bible has to say about understanding our children. Are there these influences and components that are important? Yes. Are they deterministic? No. There's free will involved in there. I mean, think about some of the biblical examples that we have of that. You think about that. If all of these influences were deterministic, how do you think Joseph in Genesis should have wound up? Grew up in a family, in the middle of all of these kids, sibling rivalry going on between the married adults, of whom there were five, getting to the point where your brothers want to murder you, but instead do the better thing, which is throw you in a pit and sell you into slavery. And then you're mistreated in slavery, you're lied about, unjustly condemned, thrown into prison. If all of these influences were deterministic, then Joseph should have grown up to be the craziest psychopath in Bible history. But he didn't. Because he got to choose how he responded to those influences. There's choice. There's choice involved. We need to acknowledge that. We need to understand children are not passive receivers of shaping. They're active responders. So on the flip side, you could have the perfect family. You could have the perfect parents. And the perfect 2.5, 2.7 child ratio. You could do everything perfect. But is that deterministic? No. Why? Because they're not inert. They're not robots. They get to choose. They get to choose. So in this regard, as we develop a biblical perspective of our children, we need to do what God has called us to do as parents, but understand that our children play a part in this. And we need to be prayerful about their part. And so what do we do? What's the next thing that we can do? The next thing that we can do is pursue the goal of a Godward orientation. As you read through Psalm 1, and the psalmist breaks down all of life into six verses, how would you explain life? Well, there are two options. You have the man who's blessed and the man who's not. And what's the difference? Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season. Its leaf does not wither, and all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. There are two ways. And so what we're trying to put in front of our kids, and as we interact with our kids, the way we need to view them is, there are two ways. And which way is my child trending? And how do I make the right way appealing? And am I leading on that way? And am I making that way a priority? We're trying to help them with a Godward orientation. Which leads us into what do we do when they fail to choose a Godward orientation? What do we do when they rebel against a Godward orientation? What do we do? We need to communicate with discernment. Proverbs 25, verse 11. We need to communicate with discernment. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. We need to communicate with our kids well. And that means choosing the manner and the content of the communication wisely. The goal is the same, but there are times in our kids' lives where they will need different types of communication and different pieces of information. And we can oversimplify, but I think our kids deserve more than that. I think with Proverbs 25:11, I would tie in 1 Thessalonians 5:14, where Paul said, "We urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all." Where Paul is saying, look, even in the church family, as we try to help each other grow, people are in different places in their relationship with God and at different levels of maturity. And we need to interact with each one where they are, which takes some discernment. It makes the job harder. But if we want to do it well, if we want to do our kids a service, then we need to take the time to sort out. So where are they? And what form of communication do they need right now? And let me just rattle off a handful of communication methods. The first one that we mentioned from 1 Thessalonians 5 is that of encouragement. Communication which is designed to inspire and fill them with hope. There are times where our kids need encouragement. When was the last time that all you spoke was encouragement? Typically, we do less of that than we should. But our kids need to hear encouragement, godly encouragement. What does God say that would inspire them and give them hope in their current circumstances? One that we immediately think of is correction. Correction. This is a knee-jerk default for many of us. Sometimes a child needs to be brought into conformity with a standard. Correction is remedying that. Where we say, hey, what you did was not appropriate. What you need to do is this. That's correction. Sometimes we're more gracious in communicating that than others. But it's needed. It's not the only thing that's needed, but it's needed. There's encouragement. There's correction. The Bible talks about rebuke. We all need it at some point. Again, this should not be the only form of communication we use with our kids. But a rebuke condemns behavior. It says, that is foolish. That is foolish. There are times that needs to be said. But again, all of these need to be balanced out together. Entreaty. The Bible talks about entreating people. Have you ever heard someone entreat somebody else? Let me read the definition and think back in your mind. Have you ever heard somebody do this? This is communication that is earnest and it's intense. It involves pleading, soliciting, urging, and even begging. It's the earnest pleading of a father or mother who is willing to bare their soul and be vulnerable with their child. It's a special kind of communication that's reserved for use in special cases that are very important. Have you ever seen that? I've been on the receiving end of that. I mean, I'm grateful. I'm grateful for my parents. I thought about them a lot as I was putting this lesson together. And if you were doing the same, I think you'd probably do the same. You need to prepare, parents, we need to prepare ourselves to entreat. And there are times when that is entirely appropriate. We need to do it well. We need to make sure that we are wise in our choice of words, that we're not hurtful as we entreat. We don't need to be insulting, but we need to be prepared to entreat. How about something more constructive? What about instruction? Instruction is just the process of providing a lesson where you're trying to impart information that's beneficial to them. It helps them understand their world. It helps them understand themselves. And instruction hopefully is received better in times outside of conflict. It's hard to instruct in the middle of conflict where there's this grating of wills. There's this battle of wills. But instruction needs to take place where you're providing information, help for them, warnings. You can provide warnings. They put us on guard to potential danger. You realize a lot of Proverbs are warnings, and they're common sense warnings. Here's a sample. Proverbs 12:24, laziness ends in slave labor. That's a warning, right? It's a common sense, A leads to B, so don't do A, right? Proverbs 13:18, he who ignores discipline comes to poverty and shame. Don't ignore discipline. Discipline's a good thing. Proverbs 14:23, mere talk leads only to poverty. That's true. I mean, think about that in the business world. Some guy's like, I have the greatest idea. It's going to renovate everything. It's going to make us all rich. But all he will do is tell you what it's going to do. But he doesn't get down to create the thing or market the thing or sell the thing. Guess what? He's going to run out of money. Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction. Don't be arrogant. So there are warnings, just a couple more. Teaching could go along with instruction. What about prayer? Two angles on this. Praying with your child and for your child, that's a good thing to do. That's a good habit to get into. For their benefit, they learn a lot about God. They learn a lot about you. They learn a lot about truth and your prayers for them, with them. But what about their prayers? You learn a lot from somebody's prayers. There are things they reveal about themselves if they're vulnerable with you. But you get to hear them and how they think. How do they address God in their prayer? I mean, when they're young, it's, you know, dear God, thank you for my sandwich. In Jesus' name, amen. You know, they start very, very simple. But as they get older, it changes. And as they start to experience life, it changes. It just does. I mean, right now, we can't say a prayer in our house without Sabina reminding us that there's someone we need to pray for every time. That tells us something about what she's thinking. Think about the value of prayers when we talk about communicating with discernment. Well, what else is there? We can love our children by faithfully and redemptively disciplining. Faithfully and redemptively disciplining. It had to be on there. It had to be on there because it's in God's Word. But think about a couple of these passages. Starting with Hebrews 12 and verse 11. As the Hebrew writer is addressing adult believers. So we need to understand the context. He's addressing adult believers and trying to help them understand unpleasant things in their life. He says, for the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. And he gives the illustration in that context that as adult believers, our discipline that we experience validates the fact that we're God's children. And so the point is that parents need to faithfully and redemptively discipline their children because it's an act of love when they do. That's the principle that he's pulling on there in Hebrews 12. And then you get to specific passages over in Proverbs, like Proverbs 13:24. Whoever spares the rod, whoever spares discipline, hates his son. But he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. I did not want to start disciplining my kids. And any tender-hearted parent does not want to have to do that. You don't want to see your child endure anything that's unpleasant. Whatever form of discipline that you're thinking through, no matter their age, sometimes as they get older, the discipline that they experience is the consequence of their action. I mean, they're experiencing the folly that comes from being foolish. Guess what? If you wreck the car, there's no car. I'm sorry. You can't drive it anymore. It's wrecked. Guess what? If you did not get your homework done and your grades dipped low enough, you don't get to play over there. I'm sorry. And it's going to hurt to see you sitting at home not happy, but that's just the consequence. That's the point. And what the proverb is explaining is that it's actually a sign of hate to try to spare them from discipline and not discipline. There is always in every generation this voice of parental experts that try to communicate that if you really want your child to be fulfilled and happy and reach their full potential, is that you'll just let them experience all of life on their own, and it's not your job to hold them back or train them or discipline. You just let them go. And those children are miserable. They're miserable. That's the opposite of what God's wisdom says. God corrects us and God trains us through discipline, and He calls on us as shepherds of children to do the same. And when you think through some of the passages on parenting, you think about Deuteronomy chapter 6, you think about Ephesians chapter 6. Let's make a couple of points about this. Discipline is uniquely a parental responsibility. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 6, through Moses, God is talking to parents. Over in Ephesians chapter 6, He specifically mentions fathers, train your children, but we understand that that also applies to the mother, but specifically to the father. It's uniquely, discipline is uniquely a parental responsibility. If I'm in the room and my children are misbehaving and you saw that and one of you randomly grabbed my kids to go discipline them, we'd have a problem. And you'd have a problem if I did the same with your child. Because we understand that they're under my responsibility and yours are under your responsibility. It's uniquely a parental responsibility. That responsibility can be transferred temporarily. When I go out of town and I have folks take care of my kids, I let them know. Grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, whoever, they're in charge. And they have my full authority and blessing that if something happens and they need to take care of it, they're going to take care of it. But then when I get home, it's back to me. Discipline is an act of faith. Because I'm commanded to do it. Discipline is not an optional thing as a parent. According to these passages, it's commanded and instructed. And so if I'm going to be faithful to God, I need to follow through with that. It's a responsibility. It's a responsibility. It's not some perverse right. It's a responsibility. The concept is that it brings discomfort to the person experiencing it. And what that discomfort looks like will vary as they age and child to child. There are some forms of discipline that are more effective with others. Growing up, the brother just beneath me, Jeff, we are polar opposites, personality-wise, all kinds of stuff, shared the same room. What worked with me did not work with him. If you want to discipline me, ground me from seeing my friends. That's what my parents did. If you want to discipline Jeff, you don't ground him from going out because he doesn't care about going out. Doesn't work. It had to be something else. But the point is it brings discomfort, temporary discomfort. And its focus, I think this is important, the focus of discipline, according to Hebrews, according to Proverbs, is that it's redemptive. It's redemptive. It's trying to set something right with your child. It's not you exacting vengeance. That is not what it is meant to be. It is a rescue mission for your child. So, we need to faithfully and redemptively discipline. Finally, we need to humbly accept our role as parents. No one else can do it. We refer to Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 7, where God through Moses said, "You shall teach them diligently to your children," talking about his laws. "You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up." And the emphasis is toward the parents. You teach them. Or in Genesis 18 verse 19, God said this, "I have chosen him," Abraham, "that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him." I chose him that he may command his children. We've been given a job to do. Whether we were ready for it or not, as soon as children were placed in our care, those precious gifts, we have a job to do. And they're only going to be served if we are willing to humbly step up and do the job. Don't wait until you're perfect, because that'll never happen. Just be willing to do the job. And when you fail, because we will, our kids will know we do. We ask them to forgive us, and we keep going on. But our kids need their parents. Our kids need their parents. There was a passage that I'd like to end with. It's over in Mark chapter 6. Thinking about Jesus and the way Jesus saw people when he saw crowds. In Mark chapter 6, verses 33 through 34, is where Jesus has found out about the death of his cousin, John the Baptist, and he's trying to get away from crowds so he can have a period to mourn the loss of his cousin. And so he takes a boat and he sails to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And in verse 33, it says, "Many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran on there by foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. And when he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so he began to teach them many things." Jesus always had such an interesting way of seeing people. He saw them spiritually. Here's this crowd, thousands of people. And what he sees is he sees thousands of people that are sheep without someone to care for them and feed them and protect them. And so he stands up, even though it's really inconvenient for him, he stands up and does the job. He is the great shepherd. I wonder, what would Jesus see as he looked at our small groups of families? What would he see? Because he's placed a handful of souls in the charge of every married couple. These sheep. And if Jesus were to walk in and observe your family for just a little bit, would he say the same thing? Look at these sheep that are not being shepherded. Is that what he would see? My prayer, my hope, is that as we strive to put Christ first, and we're all edified and built up and trying to do life together, my prayer is that those who are worshiping here, Jesus would walk in on those families and watch them for a little bit and go, "These sheep are being shepherded." Imperfectly? Yes. Inconsistently? Sure. But the two shepherds that I put them in charge of, they're doing the best they can. Hopefully that's what he sees. How would Jesus evaluate those in our care? I think it's helpful. It's convicting for me to think about it that way. We need to step up and do it. We need to step up and do it. And to all of the kids who've been hearing all of this, you're going to get home and go, yeah! No. Be patient. Be patient with your parents as they try to do this. And as you get older and understand more of what they're doing, I'll tell you what, I love my parents more and more every year that I age. As I look back on my childhood, which becomes such a small part of my life the older I get. But as you come to appreciate what the job that your parents are trying to do, thank them for that. Thank them for that. If there's any way that we can be an encouragement to you this morning in your parenting, please let us know while we stand and while we sing.